Hi, I'm Jennifer Pomerantz. I'm going to be speaking about the FDA's problems with food labeling and their lack of authority and enforcement. The paper on which this is based is in press at the American Journal of Law and Medicine, and it should be published by the end of the year, I think. I have no relationships to disclose as well. The background of my talk is that basically the public health research really shows that a lot of our nutrition-related diseases stem from overconsumption of highly processed foods, and except for the fast food industry, most highly processed foods are the packaged foods that you find in the supermarket that are regulated by the FDA. And there, if any of you has ever bought food, you've likely seen on the package a lot of questionable and misleading claims that claim that a food product is healthy when you know it is not. And in my research, I found that a lot of the problems stem from actually a lack of authority that the FDA had that I was pretty surprised to find out about. And so I will suggest ways to fill the gaps in the FDA's authority, but also a method to overhaul the entire system. So the definition of misbranded food is quite long. It includes things like false and misleading labels, things that are not properly named or identified, or missing required disclosures or nutrition information, such as the nutrition facts panel or ingredient lists, or if health and nutrition claims are not made according to regulations. The false and misleading label is often not enforced at all. So the FDA just does not actually enforce that prohibition. And in some other aspects of its regulatory authority, this one part of the definition is actually taken out from a lot of enforcement mechanisms. So the idea of enforcing a misleading label is it doesn't happen from just the FDA. And the other thing is that not all claims have specific requirements. So there are claims that we'll see that I'll show you in a few slides that don't actually have any requirements for their use. In addition to this, a lot of the requirements that we do have now are extremely lax. In 1990, when Congress passed the Nutrition Labeling and Education Act, the FDA passed regulations in 1993 that were really innovative at the time, but which are now completely outdated and really don't reflect A, current science, or B, what's going on with the labeling of our food today. So I call this issue, it's a dual issue of actual misbranding products plus permissible but questionable claims, and it seems that it's just misleading food labels. And so that kind of captures both problems that we're seeing. Just to mention the First Amendment for a minute, we know that the First Amendment protects all commercial speech, and food labels and packaging are protected commercial speech. But under the commercial speech doctrine, false, deceptive, and misleading speech that's proven to be misleading is not protected as commercial speech, and the government can regulate it and completely ban that type of commercial speech. Potentially misleading speech, which is speech that can be presented in a way that's not misleading, cannot be banned, but the government may enact required disclosures or other methods to make sure that the speech is not misleading. And that's actually nutrition facts panel, the required ingredient list. These are based on that idea that we want to have factual disclosures and to be clear and able to communicate the facts to consumers in a form that's necessary to prevent deception. So current labeling practices, I'm going to go through a couple of problems that we see, and then I'm going to show you pictures of food products that have these problems. So weak enforcement, I will talk about after I show you the food products, but there are weak requirements that allow a lot of these problems to exist. Product names, specifically things for juice, are allowed to be called one name even though the juice is not actually that juice, and I'll show you. Tons of unhealthy products are fortified. I mean, the amount of vitamin C that you can find in candy is ridiculous, and there's no vitamin C deficiency in the country, but yet vitamin C is in every food product. And there are new terms arising all the time, evaporated corn syrup, cane juice is the new one. The natural claims are on everything, and so these bring new problems to the FDA. Health claims are relatively unutilized. I wouldn't say that they should be, but they're not utilized very much on food products. A health claim is something to the effect of folic acid in a diet will reduce the chances that a mother will have a child with a birth defect. That's a very long and scientific claim. It's almost never used on food products. But the good thing about health claims are that there's a disqualifying nutrient list that if a food product has too much total fat, saturated fat, sodium, or cholesterol, the product cannot actually have a health claim. This list does not include trans fat or added sugar. So if a food product that has trans fat or added, a lot of added sugar can still have health claims. But the real issue is for nutrient content claims. About 86% of all claims on food packaging are nutrient content claims. These are things like low sodium, high fiber, things like that. And they are often on products that are very high in sugar. And I think this, to me, is the biggest labeling problem that we have today. And so the disqualifying list is not disqualifying for nutrient content claims. All it means is that a manufacturer must have a note to consult the nutrition facts panel. There's no research to indicate whether this is effective or does anything, and so I'd love to see a study on that. But the same problem exists, that trans fat is not a disqualifier and added sugar is the biggest problem. The third type of claim is structure function claims. These are things like calcium builds strong bones. There's no pre-approval for structure function claims, so the manufacturer alone is responsible for their accuracy. This causes a lot of problems, as we'll see. So the first problem that I'm sure most people are aware about are energy drinks. Now there's also, in addition to energy drinks, which are highly caffeinated beverages that tout energy, have unapproved and approved additives in them. A lot of them label themselves as dietary supplements. It's starting to change, but it's actually a problem because they're actually beverages under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. The FDA doesn't enforce this at all, but when they're beverages, they're not required to report adverse health effects of their products. So a lot of the companies are now switching back to calling them beverages so they can avoid these reporting issues. So these are a hugely problematic category, and now there's caffeinated food, which the FDA said it's prepared to regulate, but is really hoping that the companies will regulate themselves. And so there's everything from waffles to syrup, Cracker Jacks. There was gum that Wrigley just withdrew from the market, but a lot of caffeinated products that are appearing in the aisles. This is an example of the juice. If you could see on the bottom, it says pomegranate blueberry. This juice is 99.4% grape and apple juice, yet it's called pomegranate blueberry. And under my little circle, there's teeny tiny language that tells you that what it really contains. But this is actually completely abides by the FDA regulations, which is problematic. Here's an example of a fortified junk food that's allowed to tell you the nutrients in it. It touts the nutrients on the top right. And here's a junk food that's not fortified, but the protein is naturally occurring, so they can put a nutrient content claim in there. That's the Baby Ruth on the bottom. Antioxidants is a permissible fortification element, but it's against FDA regulations to fortify soda. Yet here, 7-Up did this, just like Diet Coke Plus did in the past. This is a product that the FDA did not even do any action on for reasons no one knows why, because they did act on the Diet Coke Plus, but they didn't act on this. So this is a direct violation of its regulations. Here's an example of the all-natural claim. Arizona iced tea has high fructose corn syrup and citric acid, which in litigation plaintiffs alleged was not natural. But because there's really no official definition of natural, almost anything can be called natural. And here's an example of a structure function claim. Immunity is the structure function claim. And so because the FDA has no requirements on structure function claims, the FDA can't do anything and didn't do anything about this. So what happened was this came out. Kellogg's launched this line during the time that swine flu was a problem. So the FTC luckily jumped in and told them to get rid of this claim because there was no scientific basis for it. The FTC regulates food marketing, and so luckily the Kellogg's used this claim in its other marketing practices, so the FTC got involved. But the Oregon AG got involved in that. But this is a common problem that we have where the FDA can't go against anything. So we're like looking to the FTC to do the FDA's job. FDA's regulatory authority is actually lacking in ways I didn't realize and very different from the FTC's. So the FDA, basically all it can do and does do is issue these warning letters. These letters go out to companies saying you violated a regulation, and they expect that the company will fix the product label. There seems to be no threat. Companies don't seem to care about getting a warning labels. A warning letter. There's a lot of reports that companies kind of just wait for a warning letter, then they'll change their labeling practices. So there's no deterrence in getting a warning letter. And that's basically all the FDA can do. They don't have the authority to issue civil monetary penalties, and they can't require companies to turn over substantiation documents. So this is the scientific basis for a claim. So the immunity claim is a really good example. Not only is it a structure function claim, which has no guidelines for its use, but if FDA wanted to challenge it, it can't even ask Kellogg to turn over the scientific basis for its claim. The FTC can do that, and that's why the FTC was able to go against this. The FTC can get the substantiation documents while the FDA cannot. After a warning letter is issued, the FDA has the option to work with the Department of Justice and seek an injunction or criminal proceedings. This almost never happens, and I've never seen this happen in a regular food labeling violation case. In addition to this lack of authority, they lack resources. In their 2013 budget, food labeling allocations were the absolute last of all the financial allocations given to the agency. So one thing that is tried to fill the gap of the FDA's enforcement and regulations is consumer-initiated litigation. There's tons of consumer-initiated litigation by either advocacy groups or consumers themselves. There's no private right of enforcement in the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, which means that litigants must find other methods to sue. They can't just say you violated the regulations. That's not a cause of action. So they use traditional tort liability theories and state consumer protection laws, and they try to get companies to change the food marketing environment, or they sometimes just seek damages for purchasing products with misleading claims. This has not been routinely successful at all, and it hasn't been effective to produce any kind of global change. And I would really argue that this is not a substitute for regulation and a strong regulatory environment. The one case that was a big winner that I think the consumers and consumer advocates really try to replicate, but unfortunately since have not, is this Williams versus Gerber case. And it was, unfortunately, this is the only picture I can ever find of this package. It is from the document itself, from the case. But what you can't see on the bottom are that there's fruit images of actual fruit, like cherries, oranges, peaches. And the plaintiff said that this was basically a corn syrup, if you can't read the ingredients, but it's corn syrup, sugar, and white grape juice. So none of the fruit on the front of the package were actually in the product. And the plaintiff said that that this was a deceptive label. And the lower court said, no, you can look at the ingredient list and see that it's not, that there's no fruit. Thankfully, the Ninth Circuit overturned that case and said that consumers are not expected to check the ingredient list to show that the front of the package is lying to them. So they should be able to trust the front of the package. It's a great case, but unfortunately, it's really not been replicated. And so the other kind of successes have been from settlements, and again, these are not leading to major labeling changes. So I would argue that at a minimum, we should correct these regulatory deficiencies. Oh, I'm sorry. As I was basically saying, that there is no deterrent effect, and there's no mechanism in place to promote compliance or deter noncompliance. Most regulatory agencies function with a mix of either cooperative compliance or a deterrence strategy. The EPA is a really good example. They work to try to create compliance, but then they do issue fines. The FDA is really working on a system of voluntary compliance. There's just absolutely no real regulation going on of food products labels. So at a minimum, I would suggest that we do fix these. These are just basically filling the gaps I identified earlier in the presentation to get pre-approval for the structure function claims, create the disqualifying list with added sugar and trans fat for health claims, and extend this to nutrient content claims. The point of this is that orange juice should be able to say it has vitamin C, but a juice drink that's 99% sugar and the water should not be able to say this is vitamin C, because unfortunately we are seeing that this is misleading consumers, and people buy juice drinks thinking that they're drinking something healthy and they're just drinking sugar water. So we need to get rid of that. Enable the FDA to obtain substantiation documents and issue civil fines for noncompliance with its regulations. Strengthen and enforce requirements for names. Fortification. We shouldn't be able to fortify junk food and just have it be able to tell you the vitamins that are in junk food. And define questionable terms. So I would say that this would be a great way to fulfill the gaps. Now, the problem to me is that this still leaves a very reactionary system, and I would consider it a band-aid that will, at some point will end up not working in the long run. So I would like to see this overhaul the whole system, and the EU actually just did an overhaul that changed the system in a way that I think would make more sense, to just create a database of pre-authorized claims that everyone, manufacturers and consumers, we can all see this database. It would reduce all the need for litigation. There would just be this pre-authorized claims in the database. There would have to be a scientific basis for the claims. They can't be misleading based on the real quality of the food product. This would satisfy First Amendment requirements if it was scientifically based and obviously not misleading. The companies would have to submit their substantiation documents at the time of the approval stage. In our country, we have a notice and comment period. During this time, the FDA can shield comments from consumers and companies alike to make sure that they're listening to the problems of both. Have a disqualifying nutrient list for all claims, including structure function claims, and then house this in a claims database. The way I would fund this process is by using user fees. So the FDA has, when they pass the Tobacco Control Act, they have user fees that fund all of its new activities for tobacco. And all the processed food companies are required to register with the FDA under the Bioterrorism Act and also under the Food Safety Modernization Act. The FDA clearly has the list of the companies that would be subject to these user fees. And for almost all of its other activities, it charges user fees to the companies that it's policing. So the drug world used to be very slow until they started charging user fees, and they were able to turn out drugs on a regular basis because now they have the money. So this is how we should do it for food as well. And then finally, I would have a deterrent system for civil fines for non-compliance. So thank you very much. If anybody has any questions for me or any of the other panelists. Okay, I'll go ahead.
So there have been studies and cost evaluations of that, but I don't have any of that data at my fingertips. So I assume what you're suggesting is that if farmers weren't allowed to rely on antibiotic use, it might make production more expensive?
Well, I'm not sure if it would, but I guess I was curious about the impact of the rising, potentially rising cost of food when the House is trying to cut SNAP benefits to next to nothing. And I guess the comparison of that with, I suppose, what a reduction would be in the expenses. Because I think you said it's about $35 billion, is kind of like what we lose annually because of antibiotic use. So I was wondering if that was trade off.
Yeah, I guess, and again, like I said, since I unfortunately don't have any of that data at my fingertips, but it certainly, I think, would be a trade-off. So it might, yes, indeed be more, it might take more resources to raise animals, at least in the beginning of a change of process like this, when farmers can't rely on the use of antibiotics. But I think that's part of the reason that a lot of these complementary animal husbandry techniques are advisable to institute at the same time of a ban or a restriction on the use of antibiotics. And any additional cost requirements there, I think, would have to be balanced with gains that we would get in public health and use of treatment in the U.S. healthcare system and the enormous cost of antibiotic resistance. But that's an important concern.
I have a question for Corey. How do you disseminate the information to the Good Samaritan people, the non-drug users and police, that it's okay to call 911 and stuff like that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, that's one of the key problems with these. One of the questions is, who's the you? And you say, how do you disseminate it? Because the big question about, who is that? And I think that it depends a lot about how the law came to be. It has so there's no good answer to that. And that is one of the key problems, because one of the reasons that I think these bills have seen such rapid uptake is because they're revenue neutral. They don't require any funding on the part of the state. It helps them get passed, but also means there's no
right.
funding for implementation, there's no funding for education. We can speak to, every state that I'm aware of requires the sworn officers to go through some sort of recertification or training every year. So I know some states are trying to get on the agenda. There's usually a legal update. But who knows what the uptake there is. There is some kind of self-learning where, there are defense attorneys are generally pretty good about knowing new defenses. Theoretically, prosecutors would know that they can no longer bring these charges, although it doesn't always happen. So I think there's no good answer to that. But can I ask you a question?
Sure.
We're asking each other questions now. I had a question about one of your proposed solutions was user fees. I know that there has been some criticism of user fees in the drug regulatory world because of this idea that drug companies feel as though that we're paying your bills, we have the right to to dictate how that's happening. Do you think that that's a valid criticism in that field, and are you worried about that in this field?
Actually, I didn't hear of that criticism before. So they're paying that the FDA's bill, so it becomes more of the regulatory capture.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's interesting. I didn't think of it. I was thinking more like it would be kind of a low level user fee. So I've been thinking about user fees for food for almost every project I work on, because there are none, and we have such a Wild West regulatory environment. And so I was hoping that my thought would be the fees would be so low that, I don't know what the drug fees are, but I was thinking very low. It wasn't intended to pass the cost on to consumers, but of course that's another issue that I haven't thought about, and I'm not an economist, so it's not likely something I'll ever be able to answer. But I was hoping kind of a low user fee, and then the civil fines could really be the thing that would fund the enforcement. But that's a good question. Thank you for bringing it up. Yeah.
Jennifer, what do you think of the changes that you suggested, maybe just to fill the gap changes, what do you think might be the most likely to actually occur? Because when you bring up, for example, the trans fats,
yeah,
qualifier, it seems like we already have this almost nationwide kind of acknowledgement that trans fats need to be gone, but why is it not already?
Well, two House representatives just put up a bill that I'm sure won't go anywhere, but it was the first one I've seen to try to change the Nutrition Labeling and Education Act, and they are looking into smaller things, not as extensive as this, but I think that trans fat and added sugar is on their list of things to think about. I think that the companies would fight really hard about anything that's going to disrupt this nutrient content claim situation, because they use them on 86% of all claims are them, and sometimes there's 3 to 4 per box, and there tend to be nutrient content claims. So that wouldn't be I doubt the FDA will get substantiation documents, ability to give, issue civil fines. I mean, I really think that we need to overhaul the FDA's authority. And even from Helen's presentation, they're so far behind on the food in the food world in this country that it's kind of like a wish list. All of this is a wish list. But I do agree with you that the second bullet is probably the more likely, and also because they have to disclose trans fat. The other thing is that the FDA is looking at the nutrition facts panel. They are revising the nutrition facts panel, and they are considering putting added sugar on that. So once that happens, I think added sugar will be more likely to get changes down the road. Karen? So that they couldn't enforce, I don't know what the question is.
You would have the requirements, and then instead of the agency actually doing all the pre-clearance, companies could join on to approved programs that are privately run. They would have safe harbor protection. So if they're in compliance according to that agency, they can't be pursued by FDA.
That would be great. I mean, I just want them to change the labels, so I don't care how they get there. Yeah. Well, and I wish, actually, to be honest, I had emailed you earlier this week about the state FDA acts. I still don't find them. I would love to learn more about state FDA acts, but states could pass identical laws, and they don't, but we could strengthen it and then have the states pass identical laws so they could enforce it. Yes?
And that cost would cover the profit margin. It would be, just passed on to the consumer. And consumers, a lot of research shows that a certain fraction of the country has a preference for more expensive but better foods. The average American just can't afford it. And so all of these things kind of work together and not just, within one box. But there is a strong lobby against any kind of regulation. It took over a decade to get stevia on the market, because of the sugar lobby working against it for so many years. So it's a good start, but you always have to incorporate that. Feasibility and policy.
And I wouldn't be so upset if the processed food went up. This wouldn't apply for mine. I would love it if we could increase the price of processed food to address it, but then we would at the same time need to address the food environment so people had access to whole foods that were cheaper, which is another whole other issue that I address in another paper. Thank you, guys. Oh, thank you.